Hello and welcome to Spoilers, this first introduction to the play The Life and Death of Jack Straw. Following are some introductory notes and a plain text recording of the dialogue, a plain text being the first cut edit of our full cast audio recording. It has all the text, but no SFX, no Foley, and it's the edit we use to hunt out textual errors, retakes, or cuts. So it's not perfect, and we may change the take and the text for the final thing. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the full cast episode further up the podcast list. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners won't enjoy. If it ain't for you, move on. But if you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land. Welcome to the spoilers for Jack Straw, Act 1, Scene 3. So far in, but, say, 10 minutes of dialogue and two scenes, a rebellion has sparked off and some reaction by the lords of the land has occurred. Now we're rejoining the rebels. Now that they've really become rebels, and there are a lot of problems with the text. It's a bit messy, and I think we can see the hand of an editor attacking this scene in quite an overt way. Though, again, it's possibly this is how it was written. But we'll get into that. So firstly, what's changed since we last saw the rebels? Well, in character terms, the characters have shifted since we last met them. They've been busy. They've been picking up the spoils from the rebellion. Now, almost all the gang are present, though the parson is absent, and Jack, the outraged citizen of scene one, is now marvelling at all the swag they've picked up. They are, presumably, dressed in the bling of the lords that they have been raiding.
Aye, marry what? This is another matter. Methinks the world is changed of late. Who would live like a beggar, and maybe in this estate?
Jack has tasted wealth, and he likes it. So Jack is starting to be corrupted, as is the dialogue. Now, this is verse, Jim, but not as we know it. I put it to the world that this sequence has been put through the mangle. It is impossible to make this into solid, functioning verse. But it isn't quite prose either, because it has rhymes.
Methinks the world is changed of late. Who would live like a beggar, and maybe in this estate?
Except when it doesn't.
Here we are, four captains just. Jack Straw, Wat Tyler, Hob Carter and Tom Miller. Search me all England and find four such captains, and by Gog's blood I'll be hanged.
So it's not quite prose, it's not quite verse, it's messy. It's not unsayable. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with it as dialogue per se. The actors did find some of it tricky, but on the whole, it just feels like this has been chopped around a bit to make it work. Wat reiterates to the audience who everyone is, and does that Watty thing of saying how great they all are, which prompts Nobbs, as an aside, to hint once again at the end result of rebellion.
Search me all England and find four such captains, and by Gog's blood I'll be hanged.
So you will be nevertheless. I stand in great doubt.
That's a tricky line, because I stand in great doubt must mean in no doubt. So lots of sarcasm there, possibly. But then the numbers are being bolstered by a new character, Hob Carter, not to be confused with Nobbs. Hob, a Carter, is from Essex, hinting at the widespread nature of the rebellion.
Captain Straw and Captain Tyler, I think. I have brought a company of Essex men for my train that will never yield, but kill or else be slain.
Hardy are the men of Essex. And I should note, we really haven't made an attempt at regional accents. Our rebels are all mostly using a variation of Estuary English. Life is too short. And speaking of short, Tom Miller breaks the braggadagio of the Essex men with this retort.
And for a little, Captain, I have the advantage of you all. For while you are fighting, I can creep into a quart pot, I am so small.
So, and I didn't pick up on this until very late in the day, Tom Miller has to be noticeably short. The actor playing Tom has to be a skilled short clown. I don't think it's an ironic thread that he's, like Little John, John Little, that he's massively large. It seems to be a genuine reflection of his height that, thankfully, only he makes a comment about. If everyone else was making short jokes, I think the play would be in serious trouble. But as Tom Miller is the one owning it, it sort of works. Anyway, now Nobbs, young lad, bit evil, asks a question. It's Nob who takes the turn with the exposition ball, feeding the question.
But, Masters, what answer made Sir John Morton at Rochester, eh? I heard say he would keep the castle still for the king's use.
So, Sir John Morton, who has a castle. First time we've heard of him. I have wondered if there is more of him, perhaps cut from this version. It would make sense, as there seems to be big gaps around him, as though he's a bigger presence in the narrative than he ends up being. He has a castle for the king's use, which they have visited. And here, I also wonder if this line is actually Nobbs's, because Nobbs might actually have been there. And as Nobbs and Hob, the carter, are quite mixable sounds and quite similar word shapes, I wonder if some accidental switcheroony has happened. It makes slightly more sense if Carter asks the question about what happened with Sir John Morton at Rochester, but there's enough doubt that he didn't. I'm not saying that as a that's just little thought in my mind. Anyway, Jack replies to this question.
I'd say he would keep the castle still for the king's use.
So he did. Till I fetched him out by force. And I have his wife and children pledges for his speedy return from the king, to whom he has gone with our message.
So, the swag that they all have is presumably looted primarily from Morton's house. Are we missing a scene of violence with the taking of the family? Maybe, maybe not. We've enough here, and we will meet Morton next scene delivering his message. An additional, probably unpleasant scene is not structurally necessary, but hypothetically, there should be twice as much to this play, so whole plots and subplots might exist. But going back to what we have, this is quite a different Jack Straw from earlier. He's slightly hardened. Tom Miller, as ever, is the one to lighten-ish the mood, follows Jack with an extension of his earlier wordplay.
Let him take heed he bring a wise answer to our worships, or else his pledges goes to the pot.
So there's all this business about a quart pot, Tom being the same size as a quart pot, he could hide in it. Is he holding a quart pot? Is this an extended comic riff? It's not a great pun, going to pot. I am the size of a pot. It's... Anyway, it is but a moment, as Hob Carter now has, or still has, the exposition ball.
Captain Straw, how many men have we in the field?
Which he passes to Jack.
Marry, Captain Carter, about 50,000 men.
Who passes back.
Where shall we pitch our tents to lie in safety?
Etc.
Marry, Hob, upon Blackheath beside Greenwich there we'll lie. And if the king will come thither to know our pleasure, so it is. If not, I know what we'll do.
And so we learn where they are. They're at Blackheath, Greenwich, setting up camp, ready to make their move. So all we need is Wat Tyler to G everyone up.
Gog's blood, Jack, have we the cards in our hands? Let's take it upon us while we have it.
The time is now. And off they go, leaving young Nobbs behind.
Aye, marry, for you know not how long you shall hold it. 50,000 men they have already in arms that will draw together. If we hang together as fast, some of us shall repent it.
Oh, he's a cheerful sod, isn't he? So we're getting some local geography. The Kentish men have passed Rochester, which is in relative terms to the east of where they currently are, having moved to just south of the Thames, outside the city near Greenwich. The Essex men have presumably crossed the river from the north of the Thames to meet them. Not sure precisely the boundaries of the counties at the time or how accurate this is in relation to history, which isn't really my interest here. What is clear is that they are in an existing geography that an audience then and now to some degree would know. The numbers of rebels is interesting. 20,000 last act, 50,000 now. Is that including the Essex men? Is it true? Who knows? There's a lot of varying estimates about how many men there are. This scene is, in terms of the lines, it's a mess. It feels hacked about. Everyone gets to say something except the parson, who presumably is there. There's only the basic needs of the scene. There's barely more than two lines per person at any one time. Hob Carter is just there to be there to some degree. He sets up a lot of exposition. He's giving an impression of where the plot is moving to. That said, regardless of any potential cuts to this scene, the scene doesn't necessarily need more. The plot moves forwards. The rebels have taken hostages, loot, and they're moving on London. They are fast moving, they have momentum, so does the scene. I mean, I don't think we should get caught in the trap of thinking a good scene is long and filled with lengthy dialogue and big set speeches. However it got to the way it is, this scene works and is effective and sets up the next scene where we meet the mentioned Morton, the King, and the wider world of the court and other players. We also, in the next scene, will meet our first and only woman of the play, though obviously we have a much more diversely gendered cast because anything else would be shit. And finally, this is another crowd scene. There's a lot of dynamic vocal action where the question of who is speaking and to who, as public speech, comes into play. Anyway, a lot there for a relatively short scene. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the third scene of the play, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I am in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your suggestions. Email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org or give us a buzz on Twitter @beyondshakes. Or you can support our work by becoming a patron. Patrons get to vote for the plays we work on next. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare and get involved. But that's it from this spoiler episode. The full cast super deluxe edit will be coming anon. Till then, here's the plain text of Act 1, Scene 3, to the life and death of Jack Straw. Performed by Polly Hall as Jack Straw, Lee MacDonald as Wat Tyler, Hugh Wellipooley as Tom Miller, Andy Barrett as Hob Carter, Sarah Golding as Nobbs, and I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Enjoy.
Aye, marry what? This is another matter. Methinks the world is changed of late. Who would live like a beggar, and maybe in this estate?
Here we are, four captains just. Jack Straw, Wat Tyler, Hob Carter and Tom Miller. Search me all England and find four such captains, and by Gog's blood I'll be hanged.
So you will be nevertheless. I stand in great doubt.
Captain Straw and Captain Tyler, I think. I have brought a company of Essex men for my train that will never yield, but kill or else be slain.
And for a little captain, I have the advantage of you all. For while you are fighting, I can creep into a quart pot, I am so small.
But, masters, what answer made Sir John Morton at Rochester, eh? I heard say he would keep the castle still for the king's use.
So he did. Till I fetched him out by force. And I have his wife and children pledges for his speedy return from the king, to whom he has gone with our message.
Let him take heed he bring a wise answer to our worships, or else his pledges goes to the pot.
Captain Straw, how many men have we in the field?
Marry, Captain Carter, about 50,000 men.
Where shall we pitch our tents to lie in safety?
Marry, Hob, upon Blackheath beside Greenwich there we'll lie. And if the king will come thither to know our pleasure, so it is. If not, I know what we'll do.
Gog's blood, Jack, have we the cards in our hands? Let's take it upon us while we have it.
Aye, marry, for you know not how long you shall hold it. 50,000 men they have already in arms that will draw together. If we hang together as fast, some of us shall repent it.